Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today in this very rainy Saturday. It was so beautiful yesterday. At long last, it felt like summer. And we're back to this strange rainy fall spring thing. But we're going to keep you updated at the top and bottom of every hour with some weather for you. But lots to do on the program today. We're going to, a little bit later in the show, be talking a little bit about B2B business. We talk so much about business to customer, but not as much about businesses who serve other businesses, especially where data and analysis is concerned. So we're going to be talking with someone who does just that right here, based in Chicago. But right now we're joined by Stephen Strahler, reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, who wrote about a tuition tax cut. Tax credit program that Pritzker promised to do away with, but it managed to survive the most recent session in Springfield. Stephen, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
So talk us through this program, because this is a struggling program, it seems anyway, and Pritzker promised to do away with it, and yet it still stands. And because it stands, there are challenges that go with it. So break
right,
that down
right.
for us.
Yes, during the campaign, Governor Pritzker promised to end the program on day one. I'm not sure how much of a high priority it was for him. And in the end, he agreed to keep it in exchange for other trade-offs in the budget.
And talk about the program itself a little bit, and I know it was a contentious topic around teachers' unions and all of that.
Yes, it allows donors to contribute to this fund that provides scholarships to private schools. Individual donors can contribute up to $1.3333 million and deduct 75% of that. Not deduct, but actually take a credit of $1 million, 75% of whatever they donate, against their state income taxes. So instead of going to support state operations, including funding of public education, that $1 million would be diverted into this private education fund.
And
last year, which was the first year of the program, It is capped at $100 million a year, and Pritzker wanted to phase it out over 3 years, and in the first year cap it at $50 million. In other words, reduce the ceiling by half. And yet last year, only $62 million was pledged, and this year the lag is even more pronounced. Through May, only about $23 million had been collected.
So there's some degree of uncertainty about its viability, because it's relying on individual donors and gives quite a tax incentive to those who donate. So raising the money and making a sustainable program out of it is one issue. But then there's also there's a clock ticking on it. It's a fairly young program, but there is an expiration date on it that's not
It was a five-year trial, and obviously it, quote-unquote, sunsets in 2022. And at that time, it will be a heavier lift for backers to get it renewed than just to simply fend off any attempts to phase it out earlier.
And so opponents, we're talking Illinois Education Association and the Chicago Teachers Union, where are their biggest pain points in their opposition of this?
Well, they just, again, they just see this as a diversion of public revenue away from public schools into competing private schools. And in exchange, they're still opposed to it. But in this current budget, public funding of education was raised by $375 million, $25 million above what was provided in the school aid formula. So there is an offset so far, and they also got some sweetened pension provisions. So in the horse trading that goes on in Springfield, that's how this credit survived.
Right, right. And so has there been, have you encountered anyway, much blowback to Pritzker having promised to do away with this? Or is this just, is this still kind of under the radar a bit?
I think it's under the radar. The backers and proponents of this realize they have a challenge both in educating the public about what this is, what is available, and how you go about contributing. They do say the application process, the state-run application process, is cumbersome. But again, it's a marketing challenge, and they say that the uncertainty over the program this year is one reason why donations are lagging.
Yeah, yeah. And in addition to just not much public awareness of the program, what other details, when this is discussed or when it is being talked about, what do you feel like gets glossed over? Maybe there's a strange detail in it somewhere that a lot of people are missing or something like that. What have you encountered there?
Well, it does provide, funding for needy families to send their children to private schools in areas where public education is wanting. Now, you can argue over, why is it wanting and so forth, and where the funding should be going. The opponent, one of the complaints of the opponents is that the program lacks transparency. It's not subject to the Open Records Act, and they claim that it's difficult to determine exactly where the money goes, and thus to be able to assure people that only needy students are getting the aid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot to this. It's a very interesting one. So I appreciate you joining us to break the story down today. Stephen Strahler, reporter at Crane's Chicago Business. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, lots more to talk about here on 720 WGN.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places.
720 WGN. Oh, that song gives me chills every time I hear it. That beautiful Billie Holiday song. Well, there's a reason we're playing it, and let me tell you what it is. So, I don't know if you recall, in 2008, there was a fire at Universal Music in a back lot vault area, and not much was known about it. We knew this fire happened, but kind of went under the radar.
I didn't know anything. I mean, I think that's one of the weirdest things about this story coming out now. Sorry to cut you off.
No.
But it's just that it is not common knowledge that this fire took place. I had never heard anything about it.
You know, like once I saw this story, I kind of started to remember. I do remember thinking, but it was such a no big deal that
right.
Like, oh, that's nothing. Okay, fair enough. Well, turns out it wasn't a nothing. And so a Los Angeles law firm representing several Universal Music recording artists affected by this fire, who did not know they were affected by this fire, they're expected to file a lawsuit as early as next week, because this is so bizarre to me. But turns out a lot of people also did not know about the fire or did know the extent of it. There are master recordings, including some of early Billie Holiday, Chuck Berry, Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, Ella Fitzgerald, like all these.
You can read the list forever.
I mean, it's a long list that goes, Nine Inch Nails, Snoop, Nirvana, Tupac, Eminem, like there's a ton of.
Elton John, Tom Petty. It goes on, and it truly goes on and on. And
it's
on.
A very, very long list. Variety has this.
Just name an artist, basically.
Name an artist. I mean, all kinds of, all different genres. Many living, some not. So there's you cannot replace these. These are master recordings of early work of some greats. Anyway,
a loss of about, they estimate 500,000 song titles.
I mean, think about 500,000 song titles. That's so significant. So these artists, had their work in this vault. Turns out it burned. It destroyed so much work that's heartbreaking. And not only did they not know their not a lot of people know about this fire, not a lot of people knew their work was destroyed. So they've Universal had a problem. Now they got a bigger problem because they've sat on this information. They didn't share it. So that's what this lawsuit is about. The extent of the fire's damage was revealed earlier this week in a New York Times article. Again, the fire was June 1st, 2008, in a back lot of Universal Studios Hollywood. And it, quote, destroyed almost all of the master recordings stored in the vault.
And it's worth noting that this is so master recordings of songs we've all heard and love, but it's also sessions that were never released. Might have been released on, you know, upcoming, you know, anniversary editions or whatever. But right. they're just artifacts, really.
And some of them are that's the copy of them.
Right. And
that's
it's kind of tragic. I mean, it's music. But when you talk about stuff that dates back to the 40s. That is truly, these are like artifacts. It's
Joni Mitchell, Cat Stevens, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Al Green, Elton John, Eric Clapton, Jimmy Buffett, The Eagles, Aerosmith, Chaka Khan, Barry White, Patti LaBelle, I mean, The Police, Sting, Steve Earle, R.E.M., Janet Jackson, so many people, Mary J., No Doubt. I mean, there's a lot on here.
And you feel, and you know, it's in the New York Times article, it reads, overnight maintenance workers had used blow torches to repair the roof of a building. They followed protocol and waited for shingles they worked on to cool, but the fire broke out soon after they left around 5 a.m. And so, you know, these things happen. It kind of reminds you of what we're talking about at Notre Dame two months ago? At the cathedral burning. It's not like we're looking to blame, but
extra care has got to be taken if you're talking about an artifact, I feel like.
Definitely true, and maybe they thought they took that care. But the point now that's what's so weird about it is just how secret this was until now. And that's what kind of sends a chill down my spine. There was a tweet by Roseanne Cash responding to someone who tweeted about this story, and her name was mentioned as some of the music, and she had no idea.
See?
That it's creepy. Maybe you try to keep it from the public, but you tell the artist?
I feel like that would be step one. It would be a very hard conversation. Certainly not a call I would want to make. Hi, is this Mr. Snoop Dogg, sir? I just wanted to let you know that...
I feel like Snoop would be one of the easier ones to make, maybe.
Probably,
maybe
that's fair.
Maybe he's just like, I don't know.
I don't want to like call Eric Clapton and be like, hey, remember all those masters that were never released? Gone.
The estates of people.
Yeah, people who are gone.
They would be furious. And I'm sure they are right now. And so these lawsuits that are coming out, it'll be interesting to see what comes of that, because what I'm curious about right now is who actually owned that music.
That's right.
And maybe that differs for each artist. So the grounds that they have might be different. You know, some people will be like, that's something I owned that you were storing. So that's a whole different story, just this is my work.
And this kind of gets into a conversation
that I entrusted with you.
Yeah, a conversation we had a couple weeks ago about who owns a creative thing. I feel like we've actually had this conversation several times.
Well, yeah, we were just
talking about intellectual property.
Yes.
But what about the physical artifacts of your intellectual property? That's a thing, too. I'm sure that's allowed for in...
Because we're just talking about iTunes shutting down people's own personal music collections and what that means for them. And this is just on a whole other plane and just a different... And this is truly physical, not just files. But it was sad to read.
So an interesting detail, though, they're not approaching it as a class action. And the lawyer who is... First name is not in the Variety story, the lawyer's a partner at King Holmes Paterno and Soriano said these artists entrusted Universal with their life's work with some expectation these would be protected. There's some duty to protect that. Universal, we learned, breached. Then they compounded the problem by absolutely hiding the fact that these valuable masters had been lost. He says he told the LA Times he has more than 10 but fewer than 100 clients, and he expected to file individual lawsuits on behalf of clients rather than class action. More than 10 but fewer than 100 is just a strange way to answer that. Why would you answer that way? Just say, like, I have a couple dozen clients, or like, none of your business, you'll see when I file the lawsuits, or I don't know. There's a different way to answer that. That's a strange. More than one but fewer than 1,000. Gotta run. Like, what a strange thing to say. But nonetheless, I think that's no one would want to make that call and tell the estates of or the people, you know, hey, your work has been lost. But I feel like you would have maybe gotten a little support over this, you know, tragic thing. And now you have no sympathy.
Yeah. None. I mean, there will always be people looking to blame someone. And that would have been part of it. But I would have been much more sympathetic, yeah, if it had come out then instead of now.
It just right away said, you know, we've made a terrible, you know, we have terrible news. This terrible thing has happened. It's, you know, it was purely accidental. No problem. But to not say it feels like you're covering something up. I don't like it. Well, that's a shame. Those are artifacts lost. We are going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. Again, we're going to keep you updated on all that weather. I know it doesn't feel like summer. We're going to get there eventually. I have to believe we will. This can't be all the summer we got. But yesterday there was a glimmer of hope. So we're going to keep you updated when that summer weather is going to come back for us so we can all enjoy it so much. But right now, lots to do on the program. Still, we're joined now by Soka Supaya, who is founder and CEO of a company called Segeza. Thanks so much for being with us today. Or I said CEO. I meant COO. Thank you so much for joining us today. Taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me on the program.
Certainly. So let's start with just what your company does and who you serve.
Yeah, sure. So what we do is we create computer software for businesses, basically to enable them to improve their business performance, either by improving their revenue or reduce the cost of operations. And we primarily serve companies or businesses in the retail, financial services, and business and manufacturing sectors. So those are the industries that we serve.
So you have worked around the world and you have branches around the world in Bangalore and London and other places. Why did you choose and you started here in Chicago, so why did you choose to headquarter here?
Well, Chicago is, obviously it's a great city, it's a great city in terms of when you look at, globally, all the, among the cities, within 200 miles radius of Chicago, we have some of the greatest institutions that does, some great research and development and so on. And so that's basically what enabled us, pretty much just that we looked at that ecosystem and having access to that ecosystem of those institutions, we made the decision to headquarter our company here. And obviously, then we have a global access, from O'Hare, we can pretty much go anywhere in the world data and just have one or two stops.
Yeah, I know. That's always my requirement for where I live. I got to be near a big airport where I can go anywhere and just a stop or two. I hear you on that. So you mentioned, who you're serving and how. You're helping people improve their business either through increasing revenue or or finding places to shore up some costs of operations. How really does your product do that? We talk with businesses who work directly with consumers. But since you're working with businesses, it's a little bit different space. How do you even begin that conversation with businesses? I think a lot of times we think of those two things, increasing revenue and finding places to save in operations, as being a very human task. That's kind of the boss's job to sit down and figure that out and make hard decisions. How does that software work and how do you pitch that to companies?
Yes, basically, we do not have any, first of all, just to clarify, we don't have any software. We actually help our kind of customers to, create those softwares, right? So if you think about it, compared to 10 years ago, almost every C-levels and executive, the CEOs of the board, understand, the, thanks to obviously to Uber and Airbnb, they understand in their businesses is going to be disrupted. And they're going to be disrupted through most likely, computer software technologies. So that basically had made it easier, for the business to understand, okay, they need to look at it, they need to basically look at it out of the box, think out of the box, and innovate, at speed to come up with their, look at their own internally and coming up, in terms of the products and services, and just explore ways how they could be a computer software or software-based, technology will disrupt their businesses. And then, so that's what we collaborate with them on. We collaborate with the businesses on that angle. and then we help them to think through that and then come up with certain ideas where, you know, software can be utilized, you know, to transform their businesses. And so that's primarily how we do it.
Got it. So it's a much more personalized solution than here we have this product. It's you're really building a product alongside each business owner.
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting. And so when we talk about a B2B rather than B2C mm-hmm. business model, what challenges are present for someone who's working with other businesses that maybe people working direct to consumer are mm-hmm. are not aware of? What unique things are there in the B2B space?
So the unique things on the B2B spaces are, you know, primarily in terms of they're just looking at it in terms of the scale is very important. And at the same time, in terms of like how it could potentially impact, you know, each other's, you know, supply chains. And those are the areas like that's unique and on the B2B, you know, on the world, mm-hmm. on the B2B sectors. And also, you know, in terms of, you know, B2B sector, you know, you do necessarily don't have, you have a little, you know, time because you do not have a lot of competitive threats. You know, like, you know, consumer-based companies coming in and doing that, you know, having a providing a threat. So in that angle, you know, in terms of, you know, you need to be looking at in terms of how the software will be utilized and the adoption of that software will also be very critical.
When you enter a new business to work with them and start finding places for them to either improve their revenue, as you said, or to mm-hmm. save costs in operations, What are strategies? Because I have a feeling that most business owners could use, you know, this good advice. Every business owner learns mm-hmm. from other business owners. How do you go about identifying those issues when you first walk in the door and you're learning about a new business you're working with?
Data yeah. is the key thing, right? Basically, do they have access to the data their businesses that's creating? You know, on a, you know, every second. You know, every business creates lots of data, right? So do they have an environment and do they have like a systems in place already that is able to capture those data? And then once it's captured, you know, that's being, you know, handed to the and the folks within employees within the organization at the right time, at the right place. So that's the first thing that we look at. Yeah, if you don't see that, that is a quick win, mm-hmm. you know. That's a quick win. Pretty much that's the first thing that we kind of go and look at it and just say, assist them in terms of like how do they kind of capture the data and then just store it and then make it easy to access. Because the good thing about, you know, the technology space these days is like, you know, the cost of computing, you know, has gone down drastically. So that means even the normal businesses in your Joe's Pizza down the street, you know, can have access to data and pretty much just can understand the consumer behaviors, you know, reasonably quickly at a low cost.
Yeah, that was my next question is at what point is a business large enough to start gathering data about their operation? But it sounds like your position is every business should.
Every business should, and it's able to at this moment, yes.
Definitely. All right, well, where can people go to find out more about your business or if they would like to contact you to ask you more?
Sure. It's you can go to sageza.com, www.sageza.com, and you can reach me directly at 312-878-2472.
I always think it's so admirable when people are willing to give out their phone number on the air. I think that's fascinating. Well, I apologize if anyone prank calls you, but... I appreciate you. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and tweet out links and tag all your social handles and all that good stuff, too. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Soka Supaya, who is the founder and COO of Sageza. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay. Thanks, Amy. Good afternoon.
Bye-bye. All right. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're talking about some food news. Tyson is doing a thing. We've talked about Beyond Meat. And there's a thing that's now available in a tube. That probably should not be in a tube, but we're going to talk all about that when we come back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Youth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. So, esteemed producer Griffin Philippage.
Yes.
Did you see the story this week about salad frosting?
I did. I saw the headline and did not click through. And because I thought there was nothing more to it. I suspect you are here to tell me.
I am here to tell you
what else there is to it, and I'm very curious.
Okay, so
I was grossed out, I think, is also part of why I did not want to learn more.
As well you should be. So here's the rub. And it's the bigger part of it to me is the conversation it has sparked. So Salad Frosting is a local company. Perhaps you've heard of them, Kraft Heinz. They are attempting...
Something funny about calling them local.
Local.
They are headquartered here, yes.
They are headquartered here.
Absolutely.
So Kraft Heinz has decided to take something very innocuous that I wouldn't think many people have, you know, take issue with. Salad dressing. Ranch dressing, turns out, is the top-selling salad dressing in the United States by a long shot. We like our ranch here. And so they've taken ranch dressing, and they're proposing to repackage it in a tube, kind of like a Go-Gurt, or those like apple sauces that kids can just kind of squeeze and take right out of the package.
Right.
They're going to call that salad frosting.
Right.
And it's about coaxing fussy eaters into eating their vegetables. And sure. It sparked this fascinating conversation that I've seen on social media and in comment sections about where the ethical line is of how much you lie to your kids.
That's funny. I thought of it first of all as
the gross factor of salad frosting, probably.
Yeah, but also why am I grossed out by that? You know, the importance of branding, you know, something that we sometimes like to scoff off or something like,
yeah.
As a brand, your personal brand, or you want to roll your eyes at. And yet, okay, I like salad. I like ranch dressing.
Sure.
Just the change of the product has not changed. What we've done is put it in a different container.
Absolutely.
And change the word we're using to describe
and
it.
And we're programmed to believe frosting should be something sweet and pretty.
And my brain just so rejects it so completely.
But really, to frost something and to dress something, not that different.
Not that different.
So what if all along we had been calling, say, you know, cake frosting, we've been calling it dressing. Dress the cake.
With food especially, because it's so visceral, or I don't know if that's the right word, but it's so intrinsic.
Yeah.
You just respond with your body instead of your brain. Like,
absolutely.
I'm always curious about the ways that we respond to things that we've decided are gross in food, because it's also so personal. Everybody has different feelings about it. Although I think there's some uniformity on thinking that salad frosting is stupid.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I haven't run into anybody that's gone, that's brilliant.
Hey,
my kids would eat that. Here's the thing.
Up.
So, I mean, I've come from this from a little bit different point of view because my dad worked in the hospitality industry. So there was never kid food in the house.
Right.
So I didn't know I was supposed to not like vegetables. Like, children have a different palate. You know, you develop your palate as you grow
up.
But it was like this or nothing.
Right.
You may eat these green beans or you don't eat. The end. But it was also, I mean, I always saw my parents enjoying really good food, adult food, you know, so it never occurred to me to like not like Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, I don't think I was ever a particularly picky eater, but actually salad dressing is one. So it's not the vegetable so much, but I think in a lot of kids, I think, are this way. It's all about texture for me at the time. Mm-hmm. And something I actually still, when I do reject foods, it often has to do with a
Absolutely.
Texture that I'm not interested in.
Totally.
And stuff that was like, I don't want to use gross words, but like goopy. I'm reaching back to my childhood vocabulary.
Yeah,
stuff
yeah.
with very smooth and rich texture, like salad dressing, I did not want any part of.
Oh, interesting.
So okay. I do understand the problem that they're trying to address, which is like, kids don't, but the product is the same. I genuinely didn't like it, I think.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, that's such a fine line. Kids don't know what they but, think they don't like something, then they yeah. try it, they like it.
They're
so
like, I don't need a nap, and then they'll start crying. But
here's the thing. You want to overcome that obstacle, and this is a, I guess I applaud the effort, but I don't know.
However,
I don't know.
we would be remiss not to point out that ranch dressing is not a healthy low-fat food.
Right.
It is actually like quite laden with cholesterol and fat. And so, yes, you would be perhaps incorporating more vegetables into your diet,
right.
but like with a cost, because then you're
yeah.
frosting them to the tune of, yeah. Anyway, so another thing I would like to discuss, and that is Tyson Foods, who I've been very fascinated about because they had a 6.5% share of Beyond Meat. Days before the IPO.
Right, we talked about this.
Which now has done well. They sold it off, said, we're going to go do our own thing. We're going to do our own little meat alternative thing. They've announced what it is. And there's a big effort of the plant-based protein group, you know, like the Boca Burgers and whatnot that we've had for years. Those have always kind of been in their own section of the grocery store.
Right.
You know, they're not in there with the regular beef patties. They're in there with the meat alternative foods.
Right, right.
So there's a big push to kind of keep all those things together, saying it shouldn't be separate. People are, the belief is like people are more apt to make the choice for a meatless option if it's right there in front of them. Maybe they're going on autopilot to the you know, meat case.
Yeah. And we were just talking about this on John's show.
Yeah. And so Tyson has come out with, hey, we're not trying to make people vegan. We're just trying to, we admit that we know a lot of people are trying to explore ways to have a more plant-based diet. They're not interested in being vegetarian, but they do recognize, hey, there's some environmental cost to meat and we should try to eat less. So they've created something that is a burger that is half Angus beef and half pea protein mixed together.
Interesting.
The idea being you would just be buying less meat at that point. I have no idea what it tastes like.
So bizarre.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea. So they're specifically trying to address the flexitarian, people that are like not necessarily trying to be vegetarian, just want to eat less meat. And then later in the year, they're going to come out with something that is a chicken product, like a patty or a nugget that is half chicken and half pea protein, which is kind of interesting. So we'll see. We'll see. But I have very mixed feelings on the Tyson thing because I was like, you had your chance to work with Beyond Meat. You were right there. You had a 6.5. You pulled the rug out from under them.
I think this is why, though, they wanted to do their own thing.
That's what they said from the start.
That they had 100% of.
And a little more has emerged since then that perhaps it was less about, oh, you know what? We're just going to go do our own thing. And perhaps some talk sort of broke down at the last minute that they were, that it got into a compete space. And so they kind of had to bow out. So no one knows for sure, unless you were in the room. But nonetheless, that's what Tyson is up to. So if you are into that, that's a thing that's happening. And I suppose you could put your salad frosting on it. Oof, yikes. Anyway, food is weird and the food business is a fascinating one because for reasons you just mentioned, Griffin, that it's like such a personal thing to put it in a business context. There it is. Well, we're going to check in with Scott Catoon here in a bit and see what he's got going on the show today. But we're going to take a break, get your news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here in 720 WGN.